This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, our guests include State Representative Ted James, a lawyer who has opined recently about the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial, not guilty for the neighborhood watch captain in Sanford, Florida, who took the life of Trayvon Martin. Will legislation be filed in Louisiana as a result of this? Louisiana, like Florida, among 27 states with a Stand Your Ground law. We'll talk with Ted James about the legislation and the anger in many quarters in the court of public opinion, despite the verdict in the court in Florida. Also on the show, former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, a Democrat who won big three times in a conservative state. He has now become a novelist, and we'll talk with Byron Dorgan about what's happening on Capitol Hill and about his book, Gridlock. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We're still discussing a few days after the verdict of George Zimmerman, not guilty in Sanford, Florida, the results of that trial and whether it was a fair trial and whether justice was served in the death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Many believe that justice was not served, and others, like Alan Dershowitz, for example, believe that the prosecution was out of line and that the case should never have been brought to court. That's why we're discussing it, as tensions still remain high a few days after the verdict, and this could continue for a while, and quite possibly there will be legislation filed in Louisiana and in other states to do away with the Stand Your Ground law. Our law in Louisiana is almost identical to that in Florida. Ted James is with us, the state representative from Baton Rouge. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Jim.
Are you going to file legislation?
I'm thinking about it. And first, let me say this. As a lawyer, when I watched a large part of the trial and ultimately the verdict, I haven't lost faith in the system, but I do believe that justice took a break this weekend, and I do not believe that Trayvon Martin or his family received justice under the law as they should have. But as you stated, the issue in that case, you know, there are a lot of sensitive issues that I'm sure we're going to talk about, but the issue in that case was Stand Your Ground, the law in Florida, which takes away the need for us to retreat if we encounter some type of danger. I believe that traditional self-defense laws provide adequate protection for our citizens, but that Stand Your Ground takes it a bit further when it takes away that need to retreat if there's an opportunity to do so. I was on a conference call with legislators from all the states with self-defense laws, and right now still reviewing possible legislation for next session.
Now, in the last few days, you've been called a racist by a gentleman who produces the Hayride, Scott McKay. I see a headline from his website, Old-Fashioned 1960s Racism with a Twist, on display in North Baton Rouge. And Scott got upset because you posted a photo of Emmett Till and compared the death of Emmett Till to the death of Trayvon Martin. Your response to the criticism you've received?
Well, number one, Scott McKay or the Hayride doesn't have an ounce of credibility to me, to the people in my district, and quite frankly, I don't think that they have a high level of credibility throughout the state. I didn't even see the article until a friend of mine who has my name on a Google alert. He didn't send it to me until I asked him to send it to me, because I don't read their publication. It's ironic that in my research, 95% of the things that Scott McKay posts are racially motivated and racially charged. So it's ironic that he would call me a racist. But to respond to the intent of what he put out, the issues that led to Emmett Till's death and the issues that led to the death of Trayvon Martin, they're similar. And I know that race is a very sensitive topic. And as a politician, folks are saying, oh, you shouldn't comment about that. You have a position of leadership. But when this title is gone, if I decide not to be a lawyer, at the end of the day, I'm still a young black man. And I still have encountered I still represent clients. I still talk to people that still encounter the type of hatred that led to the deaths of both of these young men. And no matter how you slice it, there are some similarities in what led to their deaths. And it could be racism. It could be the level of comfort that we have in a community when confronted with people that didn't grow up like we did. I'm one of those folks who have been blessed to grow up and interact with children of all races all my life. So I don't have that level of discomfort when I encounter other folks that don't look like me.
All right. And since Scott McKay's name came up and you made some pointed remarks about him, if Scott is listening by chance, if he calls, we'll be happy to put him on with Ted James. And if he's not listening, and I'm sure he'll hear about your remarks, we certainly invite Scott to appear on this show in an effort to be fair to all people involved in this discussion. Do you think anybody could come away with a different point of view, Ted, and not be racist?
I hope so. When I talk about race, I think that I won't just jump up and say that folks are racist. I participated in the dialogue on race here in Baton Rouge, and what we learned, a lot of our beliefs come from what we have experienced in life. And I think that based on a lot of the commentary around this trial, a lot of the comments behind juror B37, she has a different perspective. She had different life experiences, and they lead to certain things that may not be comfortable. Does it arise to racism? In certain cases, of course, you could point to racism, but I believe that it all goes back to our level of comfort and our life experiences, because it was obvious from her comments that she could not relate to the life of Trayvon Martin based on her comments about Rachel Gentile. And in her voice, as she spoke, she speaks so passionately about George. She called him George like she knew him. And I believe she related more to him, to his lifestyle, as opposed to that of Trayvon Martin, who, unfortunately, because George Zimmerman took his life, didn't have the opportunity to tell his side of the story.
She might know George Zimmerman.
She might. You know, Stanford is a small community, and that leads to other issues. You know, I have the benefit and sometimes the curse of looking at things from different angles. I have to look at it as a legislative angle and make sure that laws are in place to protect innocent children, not just black children, all innocent children, and allow people to protect their homes. And as a lawyer, I have to make sure that my clients, their constitutional rights have been protected. We have to make sure that attorneys on both sides, prosecution and defense, use challenges for jurors in a way that doesn't incite race. And I know, because I see it every single day, that there are a lot of research behind it. The numbers will tell you that black defendants fare better when they have a jury of their peers. Trayvon Martin did not have a jury of his peers. There's no way to slice that pie. He did not have a jury of his peers, and the Constitution affords him that right.
297-5633. We will go to the phone lines in just a moment for Representative Ted James, a Democrat from Baton Rouge. Now, a question from Judy. She asks, how would you repeal Stand Your Ground? What kind of legislation would be involved?
In the law, that duty under traditional self-defense to retreat if you feel threatened, that duty was erased with the Stand Your Ground provision in our laws. And it would be simply to either remove that provision or add language that will codify and mandate if you have a way out, mm-hmm. you must exercise that way out. And, you know, what I find troubling is, you know, some folks say that Trayvon caused his death because he should have run. He should have run home. But you acquit George Zimmerman on the basis of Stand Your Ground. But Trayvon Martin didn't have the right to stand his ground. Mm-hmm. And that's troubling to me.
Well, and I guess the question is, what would have happened if Trayvon had ended up with a gun and shot Zimmerman? Based on the law, it would seem that he should have been acquitted as well. This law is such that if two men get in a fight and one of them has a gun, as a commentator on National Public Radio said earlier this week, it's pretty much a jump ball.
Exactly. And even Mark O'Mara, he talked about it last night, and he even admitted to the fact that the issue is with Stand Your Ground. And he talked about how Stand Your Ground needs to be looked at and reviewed. And I know that, he's represented folks like Trayvon. But you brought up an excellent point. Had Trayvon been the one with the gun and this thing had worked out a different way, will it have taken 20 plus days for him to be arrested? I doubt it. And, you know, and I know that comment makes folks feel uncomfortable.
Well, and would he be acquitted? Would he be acquitted?
Not with that jury. That's my opinion. A jury of his peers, maybe. But the facts of this case, to me, and no, I didn't watch every single portion, but the facts that I, the things that I saw, it was great lawyers on both sides. Manslaughter, at the least. You know, George Zimmerman started this altercation, and it ended up an innocent child who was on his way home lost his life.
Don in Mid-City. Don, good morning. You're on the air with Ted James.
Hello, Representative James.
Good morning.
Good morning. I live in Baton Rouge, and, you know, I've witnessed a lot in my time. I was educated in the inner-city schools, and I went on to Louisiana Tech, which is a, you know, predominantly white school, and I happen to be an attorney also, and I look at what's going on, especially when I go to court, and I'm sure you see the disparity in court also.
Yes, I do.
With the charges, with the marijuana charges, and with some other criminal charges that are going on, but at least I think that was prosecutorial misconduct. That was the sorriest representation of a client I've seen ever. It was as if they were doing it just to make the country complacent.
All right. Do you think the prosecution did a poor job?
I hate to play Monday morning quarterback, because had the verdict gone the other way, we would be criticizing the defense. I believe looking at it post-trial, post-verdict, as an attorney, I can see some things that I would have done differently. The prosecution, they were presented with a very hard set of facts. I think that they failed Gentile by not properly preparing her for that testimony. It was obvious to me that if she was your star witness, they didn't put the proper time into preparing her for that testimony.
Ricardo downtown. Hi, Ricardo. You're on with Ted James.
How you guys doing this morning?
Right.
I know both of you very well. Listen, this is my question. Ted, do you believe that the jury, in, you know, after all this was decided, do you believe that they are saying that it is okay to kill Trayvon because that's legal, but it is not okay to murder Trayvon because that's illegal? The difference between killing and murdering, can you explain that a little bit according to the laws?
I can't speak to the mental psyche of the jury, but with an acquittal of George Zimmerman, they basically said that it was okay for an armed man to kill and put a bullet through the heart of an innocent child. We've only heard from one juror, and then I saw a statement from the remaining five that attempted to distance themselves from her comments. So I don't know what their mental state was, but you can only take one thing away, and that is it's okay to murder innocent children.
HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB.
Good morning. As a retired officer, two things come to mind, and number one, the primary one, is that the people of East Baton Rouge Parish should be commended for not taking to the streets in protest over what's doing national news. Number one, it brings back to memory the private armed security guard who shot a suspect breaking into a car around Southern University a few years back. The second incident was the white man who got beat half to death because he was in the wrong part of town. My question is this. Do you think that we would be seeing all of these protests throughout our country, other than East Baton Rouge Parish, if Mr. Zimmerman would have been African-American?
Number one, we did have a protest here in Baton Rouge, and I won't say a protest, I would say a demonstration, because folks were angry, upset, but the message was about peace. Had this been an African-American? No, I don't. I don't think so, because it is something that happens so rarely in our society, and as African Americans, when this continues to happen and you continue to see these stories, it causes folks to respond.
297-5633, your number. We'll be back in 90 seconds with Representative Ted James. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Representative Ted James with us. We're discussing the aftermath of the George Zimmerman acquittal and the death of Trayvon Martin. And we will, of course, talk about a few other items with Representative James before we part company. So please be brief in your remarks. There are many people who are attempting to have their voice heard, and this is understandable considering the passions involved in this particular case. Aaron on Jefferson Highway. Aaron, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Jim. And I do have a question, but I did want to make a very brief comment. I think it's bold that your guest is taking on such a sensitive subject. Regardless of who you are or your position in the community, it's not easy to talk about, but still something that needs to be. I guess my question is this. I still don't understand what Trayvon was supposed to do in his situation. And so what can we do as citizens and voters to make our voice more heard, to improve the gun control laws? What can the governor do? What kind of steps can we take to make sure this doesn't happen again?
Well, you know, gun control continues to be a debate, and the citizens of the state of Louisiana have made it clear by their vote where they stand with rights. But, you know, it's ironic to me that people that are so attached and feel so strongly about the Second Amendment have problems with people in this situation exercising their First Amendment right to speak and demonstrate peacefully about how they feel about the verdict. This is another example of our need as elected officials to enact some type of continue to enact measures that help us with gun control, because it's an issue, and it's not just an issue with this situation and with Trayvon Martin, but these are issues that I see every day in my district. And, you know, and the caller mentioned the situation at the gas station. I tweeted about that, too. Those folks deserve to be brought to justice. I read that Hilla Moore decided to pursue an habitual offender as opposed to a hate crime. I believe it was a hate crime, but habitual offender provides stricter penalties. And that was the right decision, because those folks need to be brought to justice. The color of the skin doesn't matter to me. Justice is justice, and everybody deserves to be brought to justice for their actions.
Daryl on Lee Drive. Daryl, good morning. You're on with Ted James.
Yes, and good morning to your guests. The thing I wanted to say to the retired police officer was that had it been an African-American that had shot Trayvon, he would likely have been arrested and convicted for murder. Unlike when it's not an African-American shooting a black person, they are normally, that black life is basically valued less in America than other life. And we just have to come to grips with that reality. Thank you.
Do you agree with that, Ted?
Somewhat. You know, black life, to me, any life is precious. But when you turn on the television and you see the issues of black and black crime, there are people in our community, young people, unfortunately, who don't value themselves and don't value the lives of other persons. And those are issues that were present before Trayvon. And unfortunately, they will probably continue to linger in our community. That's why it's so important. And anybody that follows me on social media, you probably see that I spend more time in the classroom than courtrooms across this city, because it's important that, you know, I talk to students about their decisions and encourage them to make proper decisions. And I've heard it all week, all weekend, through text messages and emails from the students who I encounter, both black and white. And their simple thing is, you know, why did this happen? How does this happen? You encourage us to do all of the right things. We do those things. We study. We respect our elders. But a young man at our age who is simply walking home lost his life, and the person that took his life walks freely today. And those students don't understand that.
Mateo downtown. Mateo, you're on the air with Ted James.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. I just had a question, and Eric Holder mentioned this yesterday, I believe, in a speech to the NAACP, and said this case is about stand your ground and those kind of policies. And my question is, I think we have to actually look more broadly at sort of the issue of gun violence and violence in America. And obviously, in the wake of, you know, these horrible tragedies, not only this one, but, you know, the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting and all of the various tragedies we've had in the last few years, you know, every time we expect that something's going to happen and that there's going to be a change in policy, and every time it becomes held up, do you think that this is something that might actually, you know, cause that next change, not in, you know, background checks or anything like that, but sort of limiting the ability that people have to just take lives, as you said, just take lives without real consideration for what other options they have?
I would hope so, but it's going to take the efforts of more people like you to bring that voice to the legislature. You know, I sat through and I heard some of my comments. I mean, some of my colleagues admit that some laws were unconstitutional, but they voted for them because they were intended to be pro Second Amendment rights bills. And that's unfortunate. And, you know, we as a legislature respond to the citizens. And it's important that we hear more voices like yours to lend help to the voices like mine and try to add some common sense to what we're doing in regards to gun control and gun rights in our community.
Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Ted James.
Yes, I believe that George Zimmerman received a fair trial, and thanks.
All right. So I suppose Randy agrees with the verdict.
Like I said, I have to respect the verdict. You know, I believe that, number one, there's an issue with the stand your ground. Number two, it's obvious to me that it wasn't a jury of his peers, but deeper, we have to use this as an opportunity to have a uncomfortable discussion. And, mm-hmm. you know, our life experiences lead to the way that we think about things. And it's sad in our community that a young black male in a hood posed a threat. But I understand when the only experiences you have with young black males are what you see on the news, what you see in rap videos, for you to hold tighter to your purse when you see a black man with a hood, or you go the opposite way, or you reach to quickly lock the doors of your car. And those are things that we can address by, you know, being more comfortable with folks that don't look like us. Remember the Titans, my favorite movie, and my favorite part was when Denzel Washington forced the players to spend time and learn three things about people of the opposite race. And that's something that we could do every day to help to end those negative stereotypes, because we emulate what we see. And if we only see mm-hmm. those negative impressions of young black males, we're going to continue to think that every young black male poses a threat. I've run around the neighborhood with a Nike hat on, and folks that I know that I approach in a superstore, when they know it's Ted James, they are extremely happy to see me. But I've seen them walk on the other side of the street when I run around the neighborhood, because I had a hat on and you couldn't tell that it was Ted James. And that's right. A problem.
Dave writes, I've heard this repeated several times in the media, and now by your guest, that the Constitution guaranteed Trayvon a jury of his peers. Dave says that is not true. It's only the accused that is guaranteed a jury of his peers.
That's a separate interpretation of the Constitution. And I can't disagree with the way he interprets the Constitution, but, you know, I'll put my law degree from Southern up against that.
Nicholas on Nicholson. Hi, Nicholas on Nicholson. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Well, I was going to say that it's indeed a terrible tragedy that Trayvon Martin was killed. However, now, because of this specific tragedy, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are organizing a march in 100 cities. Yet, in the meantime, black kids are killing other black kids on a daily basis. But Sharpton and Jackson do not react to this killing. It seems like for them, it's okay to have blacks kill black. Can you comment on that, please?
You know, and I don't purport to follow the lead of Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, but I could definitely comment to the fact that this is ongoing work for them. And I've heard both of the gentlemen speak on multiple occasions about issues of black-on-black crime, but you don't see those issues because it's not a national tragedy like what's going on with Trayvon Martin. But those are issues that need to be addressed on all of our levels. Black-on-black crime is an issue in our community. The disparities in education, all of those are issues. And unfortunately, those are brought to the light when we have a national tragedy. But we go every single day trying to address those things.
Tom on Blue Bonnet. Hi, Tom. You're on with Representative Ted James.
Yes, I don't know. I'm coming in late to the program. Whether you had mentioned or were aware of a case in Thibodaux where it appears the Stand Your Ground legislation in Louisiana, which is almost identical to Florida's, having been put forward as model legislation by ALEC, there was a case in Thibodaux where gang-related, black-on-black, person in the street has an argument with people in the car who are looking to get revenge. The people in the car drive away, and the person who's being driven away from fires a gun into the car, shoots and kills somebody. The sheriff did not choose to arrest anybody, or the shooter, because he said that stand your ground was the law in Louisiana. Doesn't seem like it's applied correctly, but that is one of the problems. The biggest power that sometimes law enforcement people have is to not do anything.
All right. Therein lies the problem, because with this, we see George Zimmerman, but there are, you know, those bad actors in our community that will take advantage of this provision in our law.
David in Lafayette. Hi, David. You're on the air with Ted James.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Real quick, one of your guests, not guests, one of your previous callers asked the gentleman whether or not if Mrs. Zimmerman were black, if there would be protests. My response to that is, if Mrs. Zimmerman were black, he would have been charged immediately with this crime. It would not have been we have to prove that he did something wrong. He would have been charged immediately.
Do you agree with that?
I believe that anybody who kills an unarmed person should be arrested first and questions answered later, be it African-American, Caucasian, Asian. If you kill an unarmed person, you should be arrested. And that's the way that I feel. And I understand the concerns from both sides. And here in Baton Rouge, it seems that, you know, only African-Americans are upset. But if you look across the country and if you look at the messages that I receive on my Facebook, this is not just an issue of African-Americans being outraged and having a concern about what happened. You know, we're in the South, and I know that you won't see the massive demonstrations like we saw from the pictures in San Francisco. But, you know, people from all parts of this parish have concerns with not only the verdict, but the Stand Your Ground law as it exists, because it could easily be one of our children, one of our cousins, to lose their life. And the person to kill them used this Stand Your Ground mm-hmm. as a defense.
Story today, front page of The Advocate, a veteran Baton Rouge police detective who used a racial slur to describe a homicide victim was suspended from duty after an internal affairs investigation determined he violated department policy. The detective, John L. Coulter, complained at the scene of a fatal shooting in January that it's my wife's birthday and I'm standing here over a dead blank. This is according to records released by the Baton Rouge Police Department. Should this man be fired? Should he be suspended? What's the appropriate reaction to this?
I definitely think that the suspension that I read about was warranted. If this is, you know, something that this officer has a repeated history of racial slurs, discrimination, if this has been a pattern, I think he deserves to be fired. I know in the aftermath of the whole former police chief White, he talked about this gentleman and his attempt to move this guy and how that was met with resistance from, you know, the powers that be. These issues are important issues. I get my hair cut on Nicholson Drive, and it might be I could throw a tennis ball to the brand new apartments and a voodoo barbecue from my barbershop, but in the three or four blocks where I get my hair cut, it doesn't look like the beautiful campus that LSU is. And I know they have police officers every single day that ride slow and pull into the parking lot. And on three separate occasions, I've sat inside and watched police officers ask the gentleman at my barbershop for identification. One day I'm standing out there, he didn't know who I was. He asked me for identification. I pulled out my bar card. And at that point, he started to apologize. And I told him, I've watched you do this on three separate occasions, but because you see my bar card and then you recognize me as an elected official here, then you're so apologetic, but you continue that same type of attitude as someone whose your job is to protect and serve, not to harass and profile. And but for the position, the title that I hold, he would have continued to do this at my barbershop. And that's a problem, because state representative and attorney, those are titles that I chose to pursue. But I'm going to always be an African-American male and have to deal with some bad actors in our community that make assumptions based on the neighborhood I was in and the color of my skin. And that's a tragedy.
Joe on Burbank. Joe, good morning. You're on with Ted James.
Thank you, and good morning to you. I'd like Mr. James to speak to a new term I heard called extrajudicial killings, if he's familiar with that. Thank you.
I'm not familiar with that, Jim.
What do you mean by that, Joe?
Around the United States, I think it refers to killings that people who work in law enforcement or people like George Zimmerman, who may have been deputized, shoot folks, and they're not arrested and are not held accountable for those shootings.
I hate to speak to something that I'm not as familiar with, but George Zimmerman, he did not deserve mm-hmm. the same protection as a police officer. Mm-hmm. And he needs to be held to a different standard than our police officers. Police officers shouldn't go around shooting innocent people either, but he shouldn't be afforded the same privileges as, you know, our police officers.
All right. Here's a question from Jewel. Why did the fact that George Zimmerman disregarded the police instructions as instructed by the police department via the 9/11 dispatcher to stop pursuit, he still pursued Trayvon and ended up killing him? If I were to disregard anything the police instructed me to do, I would be charged with resistance or something. Why was this not a point?
I think that's an excellent point by the listener, and it's something that I believe the prosecution should have hammered in on, the fact that George Zimmerman, he didn't listen. He decided, he made up in his mind that he knew that there had been robberies in his neighborhood by black males. And when he saw this black male, he had made up in his mind that it wouldn't happen on that day, not on his watch. And he followed him in his car. He pursued him. He stalked him. And it led to an encounter that led to an innocent child. Let me mm-hmm. say that again, an innocent child losing his life. That fact alone, all of the 911 call, who was screaming, whose witnesses had more credibility, all of that was a wash to me, because George Zimmerman, he started this confrontation and it ended. You know, they talked about the fight. It's obvious who lost the fight. There's only one person that could tell a story. Trayvon Martin lost the fight.
Teddy in Denham Springs, please be brief. Teddy, you're on with Ted James.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. As far as the course of the trial, I feel a terrible ambivalence, because I understand from the evidence that's been released and the statements that have been released what the law was, and that according to the court and the jury, Zimmerman did not, in fact, violate Florida law. But he is obviously guilty of what one juror referred to as poor judgment.
We'll get Ted James to respond, and then we'll hear from former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and in just a few moments we'll be hearing from a fine gentleman, Byron Dorgan, 20 years as a U.S. Senator, a distinguished career on Capitol Hill, now followed by a promising career as a novelist. His latest work is Gridlock, but I wanted Ted James to respond to the last question or comment from Teddy. What about George Zimmerman and poor judgment? You can't go to jail for poor judgment, but was there a conviction that would have been possible short of second-degree murder that might have been appropriate in this case?
I think that manslaughter was appropriate, and it goes back to what the young lady, the juror, mentioned. She commented several times, he went above and beyond. He went too far, and that in and of itself deserved a conviction. But this whole issue, Jim, and I applaud you for for speaking about this issue. It goes to something that's more sensitive in our community, and those are issues of race and bias, and ultimately the level of comfort that we have. You know, as a black mother, the conversations that you have with your sons and your fathers, the conversations that my parents had with me are unlike conversations that my white friends had with their parents. You know, don't go certain places, you know, always be prepared when you're encountered by a police officer to yes, sir, no, sir. Don't seem nervous. You know, don't go certain places, you know, and those conversations, you know, it, I would hope that I don't have to have those same conversations with my son if I'm blessed to have one. And it's important that we use this opportunity to, you know, become more familiar with our community as a whole.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good to visit with you, Ted James. We're joined by Senator Byron Dorgan. He served as a U.S. Congressman and U.S. Senator for the great state of North Dakota for 30 years, 20 of those years in the U.S. Senate, before retiring 2 years ago. He was chairman of the Senate committee and subcommittees on the issues of energy, aviation, appropriations, water policy, and Indian affairs. And he is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Take This Job and Ship It. His latest work with David Hagberg is called Gridlock, a novel that is quite compelling about issues that are active in the world in which we live. Good morning, Senator Byron Dorgan.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, and certainly a man who served 30 years on Capitol Hill. Usually you would be lobbying rather than writing. you may be doing some of that as well, but you're a pretty good writer.
Well, thank you very much. It's, you know, I've written, this is my fourth book, and this is with David Hagberg, this two-book series of thrillers, they're called, but I like to write, and when I decided to leave the Congress, I left after 30 years. I wanted to do some teaching, which I'm doing at Georgetown University, and writing and consulting. I'm not a lobbyist, but I'm doing some business consulting and serving on some boards. But I really enjoy writing.
Well, this is a thriller. It's about something that is certainly part of our world, the energy challenge, our addiction to foreign oil. Certainly is something you know a lot about.
Well, you know, Leon Panetta, before he left as Secretary of Defense recently, he said the next Pearl Harbor may well be a cyber terror attack. and he's right about that. You know, we're used to wars being fought with things that explode. But the cyber terror attack may well be a digital war, and shutting down the American electric grid system is high on the priority list for terrorists. And so we've written a novel about that, and it's about the Russians create a virus, the Iranians steal it from them, and then use a hacker in Amsterdam to begin shutting down the American electric power grid system. You can imagine the chaos that results from that. And so it's a book that I think you'll be able to sleep after you read it, but it'll be hard to stop turning the pages. I think it's a good book.
Well, two Iranian agents hand $1 million to a Russian engineer in exchange for a thumb drive containing a deadly computer virus that could shut down all electrical power in the United States at a keystroke. And then we go to rural North Dakota, an area that Senator Dorgan knows well, and what happens there?
Well, there's a lineman is electrocuted fixing a line that's shot out with a 50 caliber weapon by a Russian agent, and it's a whole series of things that describe step by step how terrorists will send warnings to this country about what they're going to do. And the interesting thing about this book is the terrorists who shut down electric power in our country actually advertise it first and then shut it down, city by city, region by region. And, the thing is, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, and the National Science Foundation has issued warnings that, you know, we could see the loss of electric power in America because the electric grid is vulnerable to cyber terror attacks. And so we decided to write a novel, and I think it's a pretty interesting book.
Well, rolling electrical blackout shut down 14 major U.S. cities from Los Angeles to New York. The damage that would happen if something like this occurred, that is certainly on display in your book, it's something that rivals or exceeds anything we've ever seen in this country.
Well, it would ruin the economy, especially if someone being able to disrupt electricity in this country, you know, the power production, or the distribution of power would literally ruin our economies. It would cause death, obviously. I mean, there are a whole lot of things that we rely on every day in this country that we don't think much about, because we get up in the morning and the first thing we do is turn on a switch. Well, that's electricity at our fingertips. And throughout the day, electric power plays such a critically important role in virtually everything we do.
Well, two nations in the book Gridlock by Senator Dorgan and David Hagberg, two nations are behind the deadly attack on the U.S., Venezuela and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And this causes North Carolina County Sheriff Nate Osborne and a branch journalist named Ashley Borden to swing into action.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do?
Nate Osborne, although a county sheriff, is someone who earned a Medal of Honor in Afghanistan and came back to settle down in his rural county. He lost a leg in the war and came back to settle down in his county. And that county is where substantial action takes place, largely because there's a top-secret government facility there. And so a Russian agent shows up, and there's a death of a lawman. And it cascades from there into much larger story that ranges from Amsterdam to Venezuela and so on. It's an interesting tale, but again, it is not so far-fetched, because we have things happening every day here and around the world by computer hackers and by terrorist groups that are intending to disrupt life in countries like ours.
The book is Gridlock, a novel from Senator Byron L. Dorgan and David Hagberg. And for those who doubt Senator Dorgan's ability to see the future, this is the man who, along with seven of his other colleagues in the U.S. Senate, only seven, voted against the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, I think that was a year. You saw this financial collapse coming long before others did.
Well, I did. I mean, I warned on the floor of the Senate in speeches against what the Republicans and the Democrats were trying to do, including President Clinton, to repeal the protections that were put in place after the Great Depression. I warned that if they pass the legislation to repeal Glass-Steagall, I said, I think within a decade we're going to see massive taxpayer bailouts. Well, I missed it by a year. But we did, in fact, see the biggest bailouts in the history of the world of big banks that were gambling. And so, I mean, but in terms of a crystal ball, I don't know what's going to happen with respect to cyber terror, but I agree with Leon Panetta. I think the next Pearl Harbor is a cyber terror attack, and we need to be very vigilant and work very hard to protect our country.
You also were a big critic about the lack of regulation for derivatives, another issue that helped be the catalyst for the financial collapse we had in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So what could have been done to avoid this, Senator, and what are we doing now to prevent another occurrence of this kind of financial catastrophe worldwide?
Well, some regulation has been put in place, but not enough. The so-called Dodd-Frank bill, I think, was a step in the right direction, but a baby step. We should have abolished what are called naked credit default swaps, where there's no insurable interest, and it's just parties that are gambling with these contracts. And the fact is, we've got some of the biggest financial institutions in the country still engaged in wholesale gambling. And so I think we still have some risk, and I remain hopeful that two things will happen. Number one, if we have big financial institutions that are too big to fail, banks that are too big to fail, that they will be broken up, so they're not too big to fail, number one. And number two, risky financial instruments like naked credit default swaps, in my judgment, should be abolished in this country.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Senator Byron Dorgan. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Senator, was your vote against Glass-Steagall met with any kind of retaliation by the banking lobby?
I missed the first part of that.
He asked if your vote against Glass-Steagall, was it met with retaliation by the banking lobby?
Well, not retaliation, but of course, you know, I mean, we didn't exchange Christmas cards in the first place. I was pretty critical of the banking institutions. You know, most of the banks that I'm familiar with, banks in North Dakota, they take deposits and make loans. That's what banks do, and do it well and do it appropriately. But the biggest financial institutions in the country began just flat out gambling, and they, especially with exotic financial instruments, they should have known better. but it was greed. And so I took them on pretty hard.
You served with distinction for 30 years. I guess became a member of the U.S. Senate when Ronald Reagan was becoming president in 1981. Those were interesting times, weren't they?
Yeah, actually, I served. I was elected to the U.S. House in 1980 and then to the Senate, in 92.
Right.
But they were interesting times for sure. It makes me, you know, when I think back, it makes me sound like a Methuselah here, Gabby Hayes or something. But it was the 30 years went by quickly, and I really wanted to do other things. So I decided not to seek a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. And so now I'm teaching and consulting and writing books and various things.
You must have met a few characters from Louisiana along the way, Senator.
Oh, man, I've met a lot of Louisiana characters. I've served with a lot of them.
Yeah.
Buddy, going back to Buddy Romer, who was elected in 1980 to the House when I was elected to the House.
Exactly. You came in together.
served with Billy Tozan. I served with John Breaux. John Breaux and I have played tennis together for 30 years, I guess.
Now, he's doing well as a lobbyist.
Yeah, John is doing well. But, John, you know, he was a very good tennis player, as you know. And so I've served with a lot of characters from Louisiana.
You were there when even Russell Long and Bennett Johnston were there. So you know.
I was indeed. Mm-hmm. I sure was. Louisiana's had some really great public servants.
Well, Byron Dorgan, not many, as I stated, not many of your colleagues decide that at your stage in life after 30 years on Capitol Hill, you know, I'm going to become a writer. You've written 4 books now.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's obviously something you enjoy, and as I stated, you're quite adept at it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on. I hope you enjoy the book, and I hope your readers will enjoy it. It's available anywhere. And online in bookstores. And I don't have a website for the book, but people can reach me at ByronDorgan.com if they wish.
ByronDorgan.com, Gridlock, a novel. As I stated, fine reception for this book. Publishers Weekly and others have heaped good praise for Senator Dorgan and David Hagberg. We did have a listener who wanted to know if you're familiar with Dale Brown, the North Dakotan, who was basketball coach here at LSU for 25 years.
Do you know? Oh, I know Dale. I sure do. North Dakota's enormously proud of him.
Yeah, and people in North Dakota tend to revel in the accomplishments of others who are from that state. I heard Frank DeFord talking about Roger Maris this morning.
Oh, man, Roger Maris, as you know, is the home run king, no question. Nobody else has hit 61 home runs who wasn't juiced on steroids. And so, I mean, I talked to the commissioner of baseball. Now you've got me on a subject that I should stop, but I mean, I said to the commissioner of baseball, Roger King is the home run, Roger Maris, rather, is the home run king. No one has exceeded what he has done, and yet the record books still show that there are people who took steroids that hit more home runs. Well, the commissioner needs to make that right.
There you go. Lastly, what do you think the biggest problem is on Capitol Hill? Democrats and Republicans are fighting tooth and nail. The partisan divide is obviously more profound now than ever before.
You know, individually, the men and women who serve there are enormously skilled, smart, interesting, creative people. I have great admiration for the people I served with. But somehow, in recent years, institutionally, they get there and the question becomes, are you with us in the caucus? And it's just important somehow to get past that, to figure out not what's important to the political party, what's important for the country. But there's total gridlock. That's the title of my book. It doesn't relate to Congress, but there's total gridlock in Congress. And if you are nourished by accomplishment and you're a member of Congress, you're starving up there because nothing really much is accomplished.
How did you get elected so many times as a maybe a center-left Democrat in a conservative state?
I think the key thing for voters is to evaluate someone who represents them to say, is this person looking after our best interest? Do we trust them? Do we like them? You know, if they trust you, like you, and think that in most cases you're going to be making judgments about what's good for them and for the country rather than what's good for your political party, they'll respect you. It doesn't matter much what party you're from.
Well, Senator Dorgan, we thank you very much. The book is Gridlock. Follow North Carolina County Sheriff Nate Osborne, who tries to prevent the U.S. from being sent back to the horse and buggy era. Thank you, Senator.
All right. Thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
Bye-bye. And tomorrow on this show, we'll visit with John McGinnis of LawPolitics.com. John McGinnis has been doing his thing going back to Russell Long and Bennett Johnston and before. And we will talk with John about what's happening in the legislature and on the campaign trail. What will occur next year as Mary Landrieu seeks election to a fourth term on Capitol Hill. And John McGinnis, of course, will opine about the latest Republican to become a member of the GOP after defecting from the Democratic Party in the Louisiana Senate, Ricky Ward. Now 26 Republicans in the Louisiana Senate, two-thirds majority. And of the 13 Democrats, only 5 are white. 30 years ago, more than 30 of the 39 senators were white Democrats. Much has changed. We'll talk about this with John McGinnis. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.